On business and transportation, and it is June the 15th in the afternoon, and we are here for a hearing, informational only hearing, and the good vice chair, Senator Girard, is ill, and so will not be joining us, and our good chair, Senator Beyer, will be with us for a time. And then we'll have to go on to his other duties, which are very important. Believe it. I'm not just saying that. This hearing will end by 2:40 because I have other obligations as well. So thank you for being here. You want to give us anything?
James? Chair and committee, we have two subjects to deal with today. One is from Office of Small Business Assistance Annual Report, and then the subject of CMS.
Okay, Ruth Miles is with us. Good afternoon. Identify yourself and proceed.
For the record, my name is Ruth Miles. I'm the Small Business Advocate for Secretary of State, and I run the Office of Small Business Assistance for the Secretary. Thank you so much for this opportunity to present the 2014 annual report from the Office of Small Business Assistance before the committee. So, as you recall, the Office of Small Business Assistance was created by the legislators with the passage of HB 3459 in 2013, and its purpose is threefold. First, to help small businesses who have a challenge with a state agency or a group of state agencies, to assist those same state agencies in doing a better job working with their small business partners, and to report back our findings. We opened the office on January 6th, 2014, and the very first case came in on Wednesday that same week, so just a couple of days. It involved a gentleman who needed a private career school license in order to open a trucking school. I was able to assist him, and this was Dave, help the agency identify process improvements so that they could start streamlining the license process, and then report the data from this and other cases back to you as part of this 2014 annual report. In fact, all of the complex cases that the Office of Small Business Assistance works on are tracked in a case management system. We use this system not only to keep records of all of the communication associated with these cases, but also to track a number of data points for the purposes of reporting what's going on with businesses that we work with. And so you know, I didn't include a definition in my testimony, but the businesses that I work with, my small is 100 employees or less, including businesses that are non-employer businesses or solopreneurs, and they are all for-profit entities and benefit companies, which is another kind of for-profit construct. So in addition, I've begun to ask businesses who contact my office regularly or directly if they have or plan to request assistance from a legislator. The reason that we do this is that it provides an opportunity during an intake conversation to make sure that we're not duplicating efforts with a legislator, and also to make sure that if somebody has taken the approach of sending out an email to everyone they can think of in state government, that we identify those businesses up front before we start working with them. So when cases are referred to my office by a legislator, which happens pretty frequently, I work with that legislator or key staff member to find out how frequently they want to be updated, and then we follow up accordingly. You have copies of the annual report from my office in front of you. It's this large paper, and you have this in OLIS as well, but because it's in a large format, I thought you might find it easier to see the printed version of this. Before we get into the data and the report, I want to talk briefly about how we handle cases. When a business brings an isolated problem to my attention, I'm happy to work with them and state agencies to find a solution. That's part of what we do. But when a call from a business is really just the tip of an iceberg, if what they're calling me about represents a systemic issue and not an isolated issue, then I will consider issuing a case report. The case reports state the problem. They describe what I did to advocate for the business. They provide any necessary historical, budget, or policy context, and they list my recommendations for the agency to prevent the problem in the future. And let me stress that my recommendations are not the be-all, end-all. They're not the perfect solution, but they are a start based on the actual problem and what did work for a solution for that business. So on this report, I released a case report in all but one of the case snapshots that you see on the page. And the case snapshots are these bolded paragraphs that have an asterisk next to them. So all but one of those, there was a report released. So this report has data gathered from the complex casework that my office did, conducted just during 2014. And it highlights the most compelling trends that we observed. And you can see that there's a snapshot here at the very top of the middle column, and that's Dave's trucking school up here. His business is actually called Northwest Trucking Academy, not Dave's Trucking School. So just so you know about that. And Dave's business is in Tangent. So directing your attention to this donut graph right here in the left-hand column, you'll see that we took all 140 cases that came in during the 2014 year and broke them down by the type of problem. And the reason we did that is because there was a pretty compelling statistic in there. If you look, you can see that there's a big chunk of dark blue right here. And that chunk right there is 34% of cases represented by licensing and certification issues. Licensing meaning that a license is needed in order to operate a business in the state of Oregon, like Dave needed, or that certification is needed for an emerging small business, minority or woman, disadvantaged business owner, and they get that certification so that they can participate more effectively in state procurement activities. So if you look at the middle column, you'll see there's another donut graph there. And in that, we take this chunk of licensing and certification cases and break them down by agency. And this is where, for me, because I'm a geek about this, this is where it gets interesting. So you'll see agencies that you might have expected to see. You can see the CCB, 17%. Ag is there primarily because of food-related businesses that have to get certified kitchens. But at the top of the list, you see the Oregon Health Authority, and then right behind them, or right below them, is the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business. It's part of Business Oregon, and that office is the one that does certifications for minority women, emerging small business, disadvantaged business enterprises, and also a less-known certification called an airport concessionaire. You've had legislation on the docket this session considering adding a disabled veteran business enterprise certification, and it would be the OMWSB office, or whatever their new name is, that would do that particular certification. The Oregon Health Authority is at the top of that donut graph, that middle list, because of several cases involving in-home care agencies. At the time of my initial contact with the specific licensing office, it took up to 12 months for a business to get through the licensing process. And again, in-home care agencies are the kind of agency you would hire if you wanted, if you had a loved one at home who needed help with activities of daily living in order to remain at home. So that license is a necessary component of competing in that field. It's not legal to do most activities without a license. So up to 12 months for a business to get through that initial licensing process. And in addition, the licensing authority in this case maintained a queue of license applications that were not receiving active attention. So because of my office's intervention on not just one but several cases, they abolished the queue. And they began to actively work on all complete applications. So as soon as a business, a prospective in-home care agency, sent in their initial application materials, as long as they sent in a complete set of materials, then the active work on their license would start. And that's what happens today. If they don't have complete materials, then the office notifies them of what is needed, and then they can send that in and get the process started. So when they opened the queue, the files in the queue for the very first time, the business I was working on initially immediately received what's called a survey date, and that's what she needed in order to find out if she was license worthy. And that's Donna, actually. So if you look right below the donut graph in the middle, you can see the case snapshot for Donna's business. Oregon Health Authority has worked hard to solve the problems presented by the cluster of cases that put them at the top of that list. They've reduced in-home care licensing timelines to about 3 months now, with some exceptions, and they have new accountability and communication measures put in place for their staff, and this is helping their staff succeed. I'm happy to talk more about all the rest of the cases that you see on the page, but I first want to draw your attention to one last critical point. And that is the one common element of all of these cases. And that is that there is a failure of communication in all of these cases. In most cases, it's on both sides. The business has some culpability, and so does the state agency in almost every case. It's because of this one element that the report ends with sort of a call to action, looking forward, asking agencies to be deliberate and intentional about putting communication methods in place that facilitate two-way communication. So they're actually listening and hearing what small businesses have to say. They're communicating with respect. I really appreciate the opportunity to present this report and for your time and attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Miles. Questions for the witness?
Good work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We are now going to go to Sean Colmer from the governor's office. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Governor's Office, Healthcare. So I think part of my role today is sort of to tee up the conversation that has happened in this committee and then really sort of show you our commitment to working in the interim to bring something back to you in 2016. So as you know, and as you'll hear from the content experts behind me, that there is a myriad of agencies involved in sort of the oversight and regulatory functions of some of the healthcare facilities in this state, from how they're built, how they're inspected, how they operate. And as I've been immersed in this over the last couple of months, it's been really clear to me that this needs some real good attention and big attention to figure out how we create an environment that is more effective and efficient and provides clarity to the folks, not only who build these facilities, but also the folks who invest in them and folks who run them. The bill that you passed out of this committee, I think, was a great sort of first step to make sure that as we do this work, we write down what we say is wrong with the facility and document it appropriately so folks are clear about what they need to do. And then the April 15th letter that the governor sent to you all as a commitment to work in the interim on this. This is sort of one of those big, knotty issues that the farther you get into it, the more you see is a challenge and just requires a lot of work and a lot of sort of muscle to sort of make this work. So we're very, very hopeful that we've got the stakeholders around the table, plus the agency directors, to make this work for you and be happy to answer any questions that you have now. But I know you have a panel of us behind me to talk more detail.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rod. Sean, I appreciate the work that you've done, and I particularly appreciate the willingness of the governor to get involved in this. And I think the bottom line is it's a complicated business, kind of making all those things work together. But irrespective of that, it's incumbent on the government. It's our responsibility to the citizens to make those things work together and be clear about that. Having fighting, as we've heard about it, out on the edges is just not acceptable. So, appreciate your work, and I know you'll do a good job.
Chair Beyer, thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very
All
much.
Right. Thanks for the time.
And Nathan Phillips. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Phillips, and I'm here representing electrical contractors today and also myself. I've been in the electrical contracting business in Eugene since 1980, and for the past 15 years, primarily in the fire alarm business. I also own and partners in a property management and real estate development company we only do medical office buildings, and we have a number of licensed healthcare facilities that we built and manage. So I've seen this problem from the perspective of an electrician wiring them, a contractor trying to design and build them, and a facility owner trying to manage them. Now I need to put on my glasses. So our statewide building code is the envy of contractors all over the country. I was recently, just last week, at a meeting of electricians, contractors, and inspectors from all over the country talking about how to license electricians more effectively on a national basis. And when I talked to them about how we do building codes in Oregon, everybody's reaction, without exception, is, wow, I wish we had that. Because we have one code, and one dispute resolution process. This works very well when we're working with building codes division inspectors, and it works very well when we're working with local government inspectors or fire marshals who are working under the local building officials. With the licensed healthcare facilities, it doesn't work very well because we don't have one code and one enforcement process. As you know, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS, is a federal agency that issues construction requirements for healthcare facilities around fire and life safety and operations. In Oregon, CMS partners with the Health Authority and DHS and in turn subcontracts with the State Fire Marshal's Office to enforce the fire and life safety provisions. They also develop and enforce architectural requirements for healthcare facilities that exceed or differ from the state building code. Therefore, the fire marshals, the state fire marshals, and OHA inspectors play a role in approving the final occupancy of healthcare facilities alongside the traditional building official. They're both approving the facilities, and they're approving them to different standards. Problems arise when the state fire marshal and the building official cannot agree about whether a contractor should follow the sometimes older CMS standards and the state building code. These standards are not adopted on the same cycles, so they're often in conflict. And we also have big problems with code interpretation and conflicts between the local and the state in terms of how they interpret the code. And in my fire alarm business, we've had this happen over and over again. A recent example is when we had one fire marshal telling us that we couldn't put a device like the one above your head, Senator Beyer, in a patient room, and another fire marshal telling us that we couldn't occupy the facility without it. So one says you can't open it with it, and one says you can't open it without it. And that's just kind of a simple example of what people go through all the time. Now, I know that recent legislation is in process that would require these inspectors to cite the code the code section, which would help, but that really isn't the problem. The problem really is one of differing interpretations and a lack of clarity about how to resolve these disputes. Under the current process, there's no appeals mechanism that will result in certainty or prompt resolution. We tried over the years to develop a dispute resolution process with the State Fire Marshal's Office, but it has not proven to be effective. The fire marshals have consistently responded to us by saying that they don't know what the problem is, and it really wasn't until this bill that we started to get real dialogue about this problem. There are instances where the state fire marshals have required costly design changes at the end of construction that have led to delayed completion, and in some cases changes required by the state fire marshal would put the facility out of compliance with the state building code. As I said, we've had numerous projects where this has occurred. Each one bows his back and is unwilling to back down. Lacking a consistent and clear mechanism for resolving a situation like this leaves contractors and facility owners between a rock and a hard place. When we've asked OHA or the Office of the State Fire Marshal's Office for help, we really can't get anywhere. But when we go to building codes to ask them for help from their side of the equation, which is the enforcement of the state building code and the local fire marshal, we get intervention at the state level and we get a resolution. And I would ask, why is the authority to develop and enforce construction standards for healthcare facilities not vested in one agency? Eliminating this duplication of services would lower the administrative costs and create clarity and a clear process for resolving and eliminating conflicts between the codes. The state does not have a working appeals process to handle these conflicts in licensed healthcare facilities, unlike what we do have with the state building code. When conflicts occur, contractors must wait for the state fire marshals and the building officials to reach an agreement. These disputes do not always reach resolution in a reasonable time frame. These situations leave contractors in the lurch with no clear direction about how to proceed to complete the project on time and on budget. And of course, they leave owners in the lurch, being unable to open their facilities. And after the project is completed and the building is occupied, OHA and DHS and the State Fire Marshal's Office perform periodic inspections to ensure continued compliance with the standards. At these inspections, facility owners are frequently required to make costly changes to installations that had previously been approved in order to comply with latest code requirements or latest code interpretations. We frequently find them interpreting code standards that existed at the time that the building was built in a new way and requiring these changes to bring them up to that standard. For example, we recently had to go through pretty much every healthcare facility in the state and move all of these fire alarm pull stations down to the height that is specified by ADA, even though they were built under the standard that at the time was requiring that, but it wasn't being enforced. We need to have all of the building construction standards development and enforcement for licensed healthcare facilities administered by one agency. And Building Codes Division is the logical place. They already enforce the standards for building codes, and they should handle all of this. And that's what our proposed bill does. Currently, Building Codes Division lacks the authority to fix this problem by coordinating the code development and enforcement activities. The problem is not a lack of communication among the agencies. It's a lack of consistent code development authority and enforcement. Band-aids that add another duplicative layer of bureaucracy to facilitate communication do not address the problems of a lack of oversight, a lack of consistent code enforcement, a lack of consistent code development, and a lack of a clear and effective appeals process. NECA is strongly committed to quality construction and protecting the safety of building occupants. That's what we're about. We're very pleased that our bill with the -1 amendments will be the starting place for the further discussions of this, and want to thank you for that opportunity and answer any questions you have.
Questions?
Just a comment.
Go ahead.
Nathan, thank you for your work on this and bringing it forward. It was I recognized the problem right away when we started talking about it, and while none of them by themselves, the agencies, may be able to solve the problem, I recognized quickly that they all work for one person. That's why I went to the governor.
Thank you.
Appreciate your input. 30 plus years ago, I think it was in the 1981 session, I introduced legislation and it got passed that required smoke detectors in all rentals. Mm-hmm. That's probably made a lot of extra work for you, but it's also saved a lot of lives.
Yep. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to the next panel, which is Phil Bentley and Doug Riggs.
He was the chief of the Fire Marshals Association.
Oh, yeah, they worked with me very closely on that.
Doug's going to go first.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I really appreciate the time to be here today, and I'm going to present to you a few slides, some pictures of actual problems that we've encountered with an inability to cite regulations or difficulties that we've had with my Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center. For the record, I'm Doug Riggs on behalf of OASCA. I'm just going to give you a few examples so you can see in by actual pictures some of the things that we've been forced to deal with. This was a one of our facilities that had a backup generator. And we had previously had a contractor come in and inspect the generator and the batteries once a month, which we believe complied with all the applicable regulations. We were cited and told that we had to have weekly generator tests on a Monday, which interfered with the work week, obviously, in the facility, and had to actually open the batteries up and inspect them every week, which we thought was putting the safety of the worker at risk, and we also had to have an employee do that and not a contractor employee. And again, we were not told exactly where the site was of this particular violation. This is another example, which I think most of you have heard about, and I think, Senator Beyer, you've actually seen this in person. Originally, the building was approved to have the door in the back. A few years later, someone came by, and the fire marshal insisted we move the door at a cost of $10,000 up to the front of the picture. And a couple years later, a different fire marshal came in and said, no, it has to be back in its original position. So that was at the cost of several tens of thousands of dollars in this particular case. This is a facility actually also in Eugene. We have a fairly small lot, 30 parking spaces. It's not a heavily trafficked area as far as pedestrians go, but we were told that we had to have a full-time parking lot attendant to make sure that no one was smoking on the sidewalk outside the building. And when asked where the certification or the regulation was, they were not able to give us a specific site. Three smaller examples. We had a building that had the wiring for an outside floodlight on the inside of the building, headed out to the outside of the building. for a variety of reasons. We were told that we had to redo the wiring on the outside of the building, so we actually complied with that and moved to the outside. The middle picture is some old, unused phone lines in the basement, nowhere near any of the other lines that had any impact on the operation of the building, but we had to initially told that we had to remove all the equipment, even though it was a building that was being leased. At the end, we were able to unplug it, but it took us several weeks to be able to get around to that. The third picture is we were told that we had to remove the paint on either side of the elevators. That's one example. And this is something that was cited by Nathan Phillips. I mean, you have fire alarms in this room right behind you. This happened relatively recently. We were told that we had to remove the fire alarms from inside the bathrooms because the supposedly the noise and the bright lights would be too much for patients to be able to take. Our argument was, number one, they're required by state building codes and federal building codes. Number two, that's exactly where you want to have a fire alarm if someone is in a bathroom. But we were asked to remove either the fire alarms themselves or the flashers and the horns. And that our attorneys told us that we'd be in violation of just about every other building code standard, so we did not do that. The final one was we were cited for lack of having an emergency management plan, even though we did have one. It's in the folder marked policies and procedures, and it was noted at the beginning of the inspection, but we were cited for not having an emergency management plan. So these are just a few of the examples. Every time I go to an OASCA board meeting, I'm constantly being reminded of others that have taken place, but I just thought it would be helpful for you to see a few pictures of actual issues that we've had in this circumstance. So, you know, in closing, I think we very much support fire, life, and safety standards. We want our patients and our employees to be safe. I would echo what Mr. Phillips said. The most important thing here is consistency and efficiency. And I think the write it and cite it statutes will help. I think that gets us a long ways down the path. But I do think that the issue of having building codes being enforced both by the building codes division and by the fire marshal, and having that contracted through CMS, through OHA and DHS, could be streamlined. We could have one-stop shopping. It would make an awful lot more sense for everybody involved. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Questions for Doug? Thank you. Mr. Bentley, are you next?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Bentley with the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent over 700 long-term care providers. And with me today is Joe Greenman, who's our general counsel, who's spent countless hours working on issues around fire and life safety code enforcement over the last 5 or 6 years, assisting our members, and is available here for questions. First of all, I really want to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak today and to talk about this issue. In our experience, there's really kind of two primary issues that I think have led us to where we are today. The first, as you've heard from Mr. Phillips and Mr. Riggs, there seems to be too many cooks in the kitchen approving the process and when you have to run the gauntlet of getting your licensure. For our members, for our skilled nursing facilities, in order to get licensed, they have to go through the plan review process, which is actually done by the Oregon Health Authority, and they are delegated the responsibility for ensuring compliance with administrative rules, including the building codes, the specific license setting standards, and the fire and life safety codes for both the state and federal levels. They also, the facilities planning and safety unit of OHA also conducts on-site inspections for code compliance at the completion of each project. Then you also obviously have the building codes division, which enforces the state and local building codes. The Oregon State Fire Marshal is responsible for fire and life safety code enforcement, including the CMS regulations. The Department of Human Services for our facility subcontracts with the State Fire Marshal for enforcement of the national standards adopted by CMS. And then finally, DHS is ultimately responsible for issuing the license for our facilities, whereas other health care facilities are licensed by the Oregon Health Authority. The current process, as we've outlined, really has too many agencies responsible for code compliance, and perhaps more importantly, there's a lack of coordination and accountability between them. Consequently, providers experience inconsistent application of the fire and life safety codes at different stages in the process. The stated purpose of plan review is to minimize the need for costly changes and delays, to correct deficiencies in newly constructed facilities, and to promote cost containment through better programming, construction, and design. These goals are not being realized and have not for many years. The second problem we've experienced, frankly, are challenges with a particular fire marshal. Following a personnel change in 2010 at the fire marshal's office, our members saw a dramatic increase in citations. And you can see from the graph on the projector that in about the middle of 2010, the yellow line spikes dramatically. And Region 10 for CMS includes Oregon, Alaska, Idaho, and Washington. And suddenly, Oregon was three times more deficient in code compliance than any of those three states. So the combination of both the organizational structure and these personnel challenges has led to costly delays in opening facilities. And that's really what we're all about. These delays prevent residents from getting the care that they need. They prevent staff from working and earning a living. They add unnecessary cost to projects because of a loss of operating revenues and expensive retrofits and changes to the construction plan. I'd like to give you just one example of a facility that, for one of our facilities that went through this process, and that's the Veterans Home in Lebanon last year. During an inspection near the completion of construction, the fire marshal said the wiring had to be replaced with conduit. Even though the plans review had approved the wiring plan, the construction around the wiring was completed and the drywall had already been installed. The cost to redo the wiring was more than $1 million. Fortunately, CMS agreed that a much less costly solution that had initially been proposed by the home complied with all the regulations. But it took over 3 months for all of the parties to agree on the solution, delaying work toward operating the home to our veterans. And just to give you a little more context, when we first started experiencing this dramatic increase in citations, our association hired a national consultant to help advise our members on how to get into compliance. Joe spent a lot of time working with the consultant and with our members to try to bring these numbers down. But I would add that the national consultant, who'd been the president of the National Fire Protection Association, said that the problem wasn't the buildings. It was really personnel changes at the fire marshal's office, incorrect interpretations of CMS regulations, incorrectly cited deficiencies, and over-enforcement of the operational requirements for life safety. So we're still having problems today, and which is why we really appreciate the opportunity to be here and why we were really excited about the opportunity to engage on Senate Bill 886. And with your leadership, Mr. Chair, and the governor's office, we're hopeful that we can work on some solutions to bring to you in 2016. We think the concept around consolidation at the buildings codes makes a lot of sense. And that, combined with the Write It and Cite It bill that's being worked this session, should move us all forward in this process and hopefully prevent some of the challenges that we've all had. Thank you.
You're just here as an expert?
Exactly. Okay. In case you have any hard questions.
Any hard questions? Thank you very much.
Appreciate you
coming. Okay, let's go to Mark Long and Jim Walker. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Chair Monroe, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes. I've got two presentations that are both kind of high level. I'm going to walk through quite quickly for you. One's just an overview of health construction, kind of break out the different components. And I just want to stress on the record that this is not inclusive or exclusive of all state, local, and federal regulations. It's simply a snapshot. And then I'll kind of walk through the building code system that you've heard folks talk about. A couple other points before I get going. When we talk, at least on the building code side, about regulations, typically they apply to new construction. Okay, so brand new buildings, basically requirements within the envelope or the shell of that building, and remodels, not maintenance or thereafter. In Oregon, the local building officials through the state building code kind of take responsibility getting the building constructed, and that's turned over to the fire service either at the state or local level for the maintenance provisions. And then one kind of last point that we work on here in Oregon that is different, that once you've built your building under the traditional model, you're not required to upgrade that building thereafter. If it's built and occupied to the code in effect at the time, you're protected by statute here in Oregon. It's been that way for some time against forced changes. When you get into the licensing side, I'll kind of walk through where there's a little bit of difference. So during construction, I'll just start there. You have the federal requirements that come down through CMS and then are carried out through the state agencies. And you can kind of see the areas that they cover. For that same building, you'll have the state construction codes that come in. The standards are set by my office, and the inspections occur through the 130 different approved local jurisdictions that operate here in Oregon. And they cover the life safety standards, structural, mechanical, plumbing, electrical. I think you're all pretty familiar with that. And then, of course, you have your fire prevention measures under new construction to make sure that there's adequate water supply serving the building, access, evacuation plans, hazardous materials. And then also, we consult between the local code officials and the local fire officials on that construction plan for building code compliance as it's being developed to make sure they're both on the same page. And the reason is when you go after occupancy on the healthcare side, you'll see that there are requirements for ongoing maintenance and upkeep that are unique to the federal program that are carried out through, again, the various licensing agencies and are required to be maintained. And you can kind of see those parameters. But you also have your local maintenance review. This is regardless of whether it's a health facility or this building or any other building, where, again, folks make sure that they're on the fire side, that there's adequate access, evacuation, hazardous material storage, and then conformance to those state construction standards that it was originally built to. The policy in Oregon is, again, the building inspectors and state code deal with the new construction, and then it's maintained. And so you can see that for healthcare, you get these little areas of overlap sometimes where you can see the maybe some of the tension points folks are talking to you about. Here's the system altogether. So again, the local government side on related to what we do is involved in new construction, not on the after occupancy side. It's carried out by others. For our system, you heard Mr. Phillips talk about the Oregon system, and as I travel and talk to other folks around the country, we are unique here in that we do have a uniform code. This is really about what we do. We have a single code that we preempt local government from creating standards that are different than the state code. We have our inspector training and licensing system so that we train our inspectors and then can hold them accountable to the site at right at components you've heard talked about. We have dispute resolution where we provide interpretations. We have regional folks out in the communities resolving disputes between the contractors and local officials and helping both parties know the latest and greatest code standards. And, of course, we have formal appeals of local decisions. Matters can be brought to the attention of my office and then on to one of our boards to get a final resolution in generally fairly quick time. And then just some of the other things that we do. We have a lot of regulatory relief valves that we do, alternate methods of construction, emerging technologies. For consistency, we have responsibility for the subcontractor licensing, electricians, plumbers, boiler operators, as well as the programs themselves that operate, the local 130 local building departments, as well as the inspectors, and then just some of our value added, which I know you're all very familiar with electronic permitting, some of the things we provide to make sure the construction system operates kind of timely and efficiently. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions, but that first overview was to try to get a sense of where maybe some of those pressure points are in health facility licensing and how it's a little bit different than construction that isn't required to be licensed.
Thank you very much. Going to hear from the fire marshal.
Chair Beyer, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Walker, and I'm the current Oregon State Fire Marshal. And as you've heard some concerns here about things that have occurred in the past, I want to reassure you that we have a complete change in our organizational structure at the fire marshal's office. I became the fire marshal in August of this year. Our chief deputy state fire marshal, who is the number two within the organization, is brand new as of September. The assistant chief that was responsible for the Fire and Life Safety Services branch, which oversees the health program, is retired. We are currently in the process of attempting to hire that position. And the deputy state fire marshal that was in the healthcare facility is basically new, and we're looking at hiring an additional new fire marshal for that as well. So I think what I'd like to say is that you have some folks that are just kind of coming up to speed on some of the issues and the concerns that you're hearing here today. We're glad to hear that this committee is being put together. We appreciate that, Senator Beyer, on your behalf of getting us all together. It's helped me to have an opportunity to talk with the other state agencies, with building, also with DHS, and also with OHA, and then start to build some relationships with CMS so I can fully understand some of the concerns that we're talking about today. And I, too, believe that the Sight and Right is a good way to start in this process. After viewing a number of these slides, we can take almost all of them back to code and code interpretation. And so obviously when it was cited, there was not very good interpretation on our part to let the facilities know that's why that was the case. And I would be happy after this hearing today to meet with folks and have that discussion so that we can clarify a few things as well. But we are very open to what the committee would like to see in the future, streamlining processes, having the ability that if there is a issue or a concern, you know, what process is in place to be able to remedy it. We certainly do not want to be the ones that, you know, takes on that whole process and makes the determination and then makes the final judgment as well. I don't think that works out real well. And I don't think you can hear that most of the people in this room think that works out real well. So unless there's any questions, I appreciate the opportunity to be up here today.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Jim and Mark, I appreciate the tough job that you have. Not only is it do you have to have consistency through your individual offices, but in both cases you have to try to get consistency at the local level as well, since the legislation delegates that or provides that option to the local level. So it's not an easy thing to do. I think at the end of the day, though, collectively, we in government have a responsibility to provide some clear guidelines. Certainly safety is at the top of the issue, but you can't have some of the examples. You can't have one guy saying you got to put the door over here, another guy saying you got to put it over here, and vice versa. We got to be able to resolve that. And I think, and Mark and I have talked about this, there ought to be a way to maybe having to synthesize the CMS and the building and fire code together. It strikes me, if one is much more stringent than the other, maybe we just create a specialty code. I hate that idea, going back to the yellow pages, but maybe that's what we have to do for these kinds of facilities so that everybody's reading out of the same hymn book, you know? You have a big charge ahead of you, but you have a responsibility to make it work, and I'm sure you will. At least the governor has assured me that you will.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I only have 130 local departments. So I think Jim has how many? 200?
320.
So.
Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen. Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Get your input. Steve Forrester and Mike Trabu. Steve is from the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and Mike from the Albany Fire. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Steve Forrester. I'm the fire marshal with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and working closely with Oregon Fire Marshals Association. It is our highest priority to ensure that the safety of all Oregonians, and to do so in a collaborative, efficient, and customer service focused manner. First, let me just start with just a very brief explanation of the local fire marshal or fire chief's role in all of this. So Oregon's local fire marshals work very closely with OSFM on code development, inspection practices, interpretations, many other issues of how Oregon's codes get applied and enforced and developed. But it is important to point out for clarity, we do not have a role in CMS inspections. None of our inspections, whether it's when buildings are new or on existing maintenance inspections that we do, none of those are for CMS purposes. However, it is important to note that local fire marshals do inspect tens of thousands of Oregon buildings each year, including some of the same healthcare facilities. When we, the local fire marshals, do the inspections, we are inspecting for compliance with Oregon's codes, not the old, outdated CMS codes, and to ensure that the buildings as originally approved by BCD or the local building official, that they're maintained in accordance with how they were approved. So where they said firewalls go, where they said systems go, that sort of thing. And I think you'd hear that that relationship works actually pretty well. Local fire marshals really, I think, complement the role of the local building officials and the building codes division. They really are responsible for building the building, and we are responsible to make sure that it's maintained safely for Oregon citizens. We acknowledge that some contractors and facilities in the healthcare industry have received less than optimal service in the CMS inspection program and are frustrated. And we concur that some of their issues and concerns are legitimate and that they are being addressed by the state fire marshal, the other state agencies, and by this committee. The situation makes it understandable that the initial focus really was on who conducts the inspections. However, we believe there are much, much more important issues at play here. First, there's a lack of new construction plan review to determine if new healthcare facilities are being proposed. There's a lack of construction plan review to determine if they even meet CMS requirements. When a new healthcare facility is proposed, the local building department reviews the architectural structural engineering plans for compliance with Oregon codes and laws, and then after correcting any deficiencies, issues the permit. However, a similar review for compliance with CMS codes, which are totally different than Oregon codes, or can be totally different, really is either done late in the game or not done at all. That means you don't discover these CMS violations oftentimes until after a building is either partially complete or even after it's fully completed. At that point, as you can sense from the stakeholders here today, any corrections are extremely frustrating, costly, and should not have came up at that point. It's a great disservice to issue a building permit based on only half of the applicable codes or standards being reviewed, then allowing construction to start, then identifying changes needed in a brand new facility. Second, CMS mandates that healthcare facilities must comply with outdated federal codes that are 15 years old, are redundant, and often conflict with the modern fire and building codes adopted in the state of Oregon. You literally can build a brand new state-of-the-art healthcare facility tomorrow, be in full compliance with all Oregon laws and codes, and however, be immediately in violation of CMS standards. And that isn't something that's fixed by changing the agency who administers it. The reality is you have to administer the CMS standards based on what CMS tells you. They issue the interpretations. They tell you that the codes that are enforced. I know you've heard, or you may hear, that this is not a code issue, but I believe that's not helpful to underestimate the magnitude of having conflicting construction codes. This is a national problem in which even CMS acknowledged the cost on a simple dialysis center to comply with conflicting standards, in addition to more modern state codes, range from $23,000 to $222,000, with an average cost of $77,000 per facility. The American Hospital Association, in a report on this very topic, estimated that healthcare organizations in the U.S. waste more than $4 billion each year on conflicting codes and standards, misinterpretations, and related problems from this issue. To quote the AHA, that's an astonishing amount that could otherwise be spent on infection prevention, upgrades in medical technology, more nursing care, and other items that would directly benefit hospitals' patients. Oregonians deserve better, and we encourage this committee to look holistically at this entire issue. I'll turn it over now to my colleague to discuss some of our recommended solutions.
Senator Beyer, committee members, I'm Mike Tribue, again, the Albany Fire Marshal, but I'm here representing the Oregon Fire Marshals Association, working in conjunction with the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association on this issue. As Chief Forrester told you, the issues that he brought up are not solely focused on who does the inspection, but it also talks to an issue of process. And it affects new construction plan reviews, inspections, ongoing compliance surveys. The healthcare industry in Oregon will continue to experience significant code compliance and construction issues until these two significant issues that Chief Forrester brought up are corrected. State government would be doing all stakeholders a disservice if this group focuses solely on who does the CMS inspection. Focusing on coordination of state code and CMS standards, how the state manages federal requirements for review of healthcare and construction documents and related inspections, and how the periodic CMS compliance surveys is conducted are of equal or greater importance in our view. The Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and Oregon Fire Marshals Association are ready to partner with all stakeholders to develop solutions that address these problems. To that end, we offer three initial recommendations to the Joint Stakeholder Work Group in the interim. First, identify best practices from other states. The entire country, as you've been told, struggles with these issues, and Oregon would benefit from the experiences of these other states. We have a strong national network across all 50 states that can readily identify the best practices that have been developed to improve these processes for all stakeholders. Second, petition the CMS to grant the state of Oregon a waiver to use up-to-date codes and standards. CMS has the authority to grant such waivers to states, and Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and Oregon Fire Marshals Association have national code experts stand ready to help develop a CMS petition. Lastly, form a joint stakeholder task group to identify building, fire, electrical, mechanical code changes that we could make at the state level to improve consistency and compliance with regulated facilities. The fire marshals we represent have extensive experience in developing and implementing state codes through a collaborative process. In closing, the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and the Oregon Fire Marshals Association look forward to participating in the legislators' work group, working with all state agencies and stakeholders on these important issues.
Mr. Chair.
I thank you both. Those are particularly the recommendations. There seems to be a lot of logic there. And I hope you're both or somebody from your organizations are involved in the work group working with state agencies to make that happen. That makes a lot of sense to me, and I think always good to go best practices. My father-in-law was a fire marshal, so I understand where you're coming from. Spent a lot of time with him on that. I think one of the things that maybe is worth exploring, and maybe you've talked about it, is perhaps on the maintenance. I think there are two issues. One is the upfront plan review, and it's discouraging to hear that one happens after, maybe not at all. The other, we have to find a way to put that together in some way. That has to come together in one place, and maybe it's a deferral. Maybe CMS or the fire marshal's office could delegate that over to the building codes agencies. I use the term plural there. Or in local fire marshals in that case. I don't know where that works, but maybe that's something worth exploring. The other side, maybe there's a way to do the inspections collaboratively or in differing. So I know some of that, I've seen that happen some in the past. So the bottom line is we have to make this work for the consuming public. We can't let the kinds of things happen like that. And I guess the real bottom line is we have to make sure that these facilities are safe for the consumers who are living there or staying there. So I appreciate your efforts. And, Mr. Chair, I have to go.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We have one more witness, Rosa Klein. Welcome.
Thank you. Vice Chair Monroe and member of the committee. My name is Rosa Klein. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Oregon Health Authority. And I am just here with my colleague, Chris Edmonds, from DHS to state our support for a coordinated effort and to acknowledge that there have been very frustrating challenges in the past, and to let you know that we're ready to get together with our sister agencies and put together a collaborative one-door approach to plan review and certification and licensure so that we no longer experience the frustration that you've seen demonstrated here today.
Okay. That it?
That's it.
Any questions for Ms. Klein? Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we have finished our work today. Thank you all for coming.
Can I make a comment before we
Certainly.
Close? Thank you very much. I haven't said anything the whole time, but I've just been taking this in. And I can see that there's a lot of work to do. But I think that the people that we've heard from today are up to the challenge and want to do the right thing, and I think we'll get it done. One of the things that I think we should be looking at is trying to get that exception from the CMS code to use our more up-to-date Oregon standards. So I would be looking to see if we can do that. So
thank you, Senator. And thank you all once again, and this meeting is adjourned. This meeting is adjourned.